Coming up on the Law Report, the extraordinary family law dispute that, strangely enough, involved a happily married couple. Also, insider trading. Is it against the law if the supposedly valuable inside information is completely made up? But first, the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse in Our Institutions. Dr. Vivian Waller is a Melbourne-based lawyer who for many years has specialised in acting for survivors of sexual assault. She says a Royal Commission will go a long way towards addressing the needs of survivors.
Well, I'm very pleased that the federal government has announced a Royal Commission. I think that that is an excellent decision, and it will bring hope to a lot of people who have been sort of suffering in silence, really, and will give them confidence that their stories will be heard and listened to. In Ireland, the Royal Commission achieved an enormous amount for victims of sexual abuse. It gave them a voice. These matters were investigated. The extent and breadth of the problem was uncovered. And ultimately, although that commission sat for nearly 10 years, a statutory scheme was set up to assist victims in obtaining compensation. And it actually cured a lot of the legal technical difficulties those people would have had if they were trying to commence common law proceedings. So it streamlined the process of those people seeking assistance.
There's been a government consultation paper which has been sent to the states and the major stakeholders asking for their input in terms of the terms of reference for this Royal Commission. It's said that it should look at identifying the obstacles for victims to making claims and ascertaining whether there is sufficient support to make such claims. Do you think that's a good focus for this commission?
I think it's a very important focus because for too long victims have been silenced and they've been hampered by some of the legal technical difficulties that prevent them from bringing claims. There's a lot of psychiatric literature around explaining the phenomenon of delayed disclosure, that children who've been sexually abused, particularly by a person in position of power or authority over them, like a priest or a Christian brother, has a great deal of difficulty reporting those events, and it may not be until much later in life that they're able to come forward for legal help or for medical help. And by that time, the time limits that apply to commencing a civil claim are likely to have expired. So one of the key legal problems is dealing with sexual abuse claims that arise many years ago. The other significant technical problem that litigants face, particularly when suing the Catholic Church, is difficulty identifying a defendant that can be sued. A lot of Catholic orders are set up something akin to an unincorporated association, so they don't have a continuing legal entity that can be sued. It's a bit like trying to hold the football club of a particular town responsible for perhaps having a sexual predator in their midst in the, say, early 70s, for example. There's no point suing the current president and the vice president of the football club because they weren't around at the time. What you need to do is find living members of the committee of management who were around at the time of the alleged offending. So that's kind of a simple analogy to explain the difficulty in suing some of these Catholic entities.
Because there was a case, I think it was the Ellis case a few years ago, and that person was unsuccessful in suing the Catholic Church for the reasons, the kinds of reasons you're talking about.
Yes, in that case it was held that the church wasn't a defendant that was capable of being sued. It didn't have legal personality as such, and that case also is authority for the proposition that priests aren't employees. So there may be an offending priest, but that the church body may not necessarily be legally responsible for that. So these kinds of technical issues are very big impediments for people wishing to litigate their cases in court if they're seeking compensation. Now, quite frankly, that does seem to be quite irrational. I can imagine a lot of your listeners thinking, well, let's see, the Catholic Church employ people and they run committees and they have insurance and they, you know, they employ teachers in their schools and they perform all of these tasks. How is it that they are not a legal entity capable of being sued like any other organisation that employs people, performs a service, hires a cleaner, hires a gardener? These are very tricky questions.
The government consultation paper also talks about the need to identify impediments within institutions and organisations that stop notification, investigation and prevention of child sexual abuse. You have some experience of the internal processes of the Catholic Church. What's your view?
I do. There are two processes adopted by the Catholic Church. One is the Towards Healing Protocol, and the other is the process set up in Melbourne, sometimes called the Pell process or the Melbourne process, and they're quite different. The Melbourne process applies only to allegations against clergy within the responsibility of the Archdiocese of Melbourne, and all other allegations that arise in any other place in Australia fall within the Towards Healing Protocol. Now, the police have had a lot to say about the difficulties that they've encountered in working with the Archdiocese of Melbourne, and they've also got some quite good data on that. So don't quote me on the figures, but there's been in excess of 300 complaints that the Archdiocese of Melbourne have found to be credible, and they have assisted victims with financial compensation, and they involve allegations against 60 priests for whom the Archdiocese of Melbourne were responsible. Not one of those complaints, the Victoria Police tell us, have been referred to them for investigation. Some of those complaints have ended up being investigated by the police because the victim themselves took their complaint to the police, but of its own volition, none of those matters were sent to the police by the church. And I can't think of any other organisation that could preside over such horrifying statistics and not think, well, hang on a minute, there appears to be some kind of endemic, systemic problem here. I should report this to the police.
The consultation paper also talks about the need to change any laws, policies or procedures within institutions to better prevent and respond to abuse. Is that something you'd also welcome?
I would welcome that. I think that the responsibilities for caring, educating children and looking after our vulnerable people are very important responsibilities. And I think that there should be more stringent reporting requirements so that these matters can be investigated by the proper authorities. My experience of the Towards Healing Protocol is that those claims are not properly investigated or assessed by the church's internal processes. For example, I know for a fact that other class members in the same class of an alleged abuser were not contacted, were not asked if they had experienced any difficulty. The investigations are quite narrow, and they make each individual complainant feel like they are the only person who has ever experienced this problem, when I would know for a fact that it's several other class members in that year, because they have been my clients at some point in history, have complained about abuse from the same person. So
To the same body. So you've had experience of both internal processes and also with civil actions. A Royal Commission which sets up a complaints handling mechanism and perhaps a compensation system, you think that's a better way forward?
I certainly think that internally managed schemes, particularly for the Catholic Church, have proven to be very problematic. They've proven that they lack independence, and they've proven that they don't work in well with the Victoria Police. That's not to say that they haven't delivered results for people who have been victims of sexual offences, because they have provided compensation. But I think that leaving those bodies in charge of investigating those complaints is inappropriate. We're not talking about, I mean, really, we're talking about criminal offences against children, and those complaints should really be investigated by people who are properly qualified and truly independent, who have no vested interests. So the best body to investigate that would be the police, or at least an independent, a body independent of any particular church or organisation.
Viv Waller, we've been talking about the Catholic Church, but your clients come from a range of traditions and backgrounds. These problems, are they across the board?
Sexual assault is a crime that occurs in every sector of our society, regardless of religion or culture or even age.
And mostly in the home
and gender,
by family members.
That's right. So it is a terrible problem in our community, and personally I have been involved in cases against churches of all faiths, deaths and denominations. Unfortunately, Catholic organisations do appear to be drastically overrepresented in terms of defendants in my practice. And I think that is because, I think that's because the Catholic Church has not dealt with this particularly well. There is evidence available that the Catholic Church knew of particular offenders and moved them around from location to location. There is evidence to suggest that the Church was aware, for example, of sexual crimes committed by Father Ridsdale, and they moved him around from location to location. He's now a convicted sex offender serving a jail sentence. He was charged with 93 charges, ultimately, in relation to child sexual offences. So I think once you have a powerful organisation that colludes in not referring matters to the police, not getting to the problem, getting to the nub of the problem, enabling sexual offenders to continue to offend simply by placing them in other locations, I think that magnifies the problem in that organisation because the offences can continue.
Viv Waller, finally, you've obviously had a lot of conversations with your clients over the last week or so. Can you recount for me a conversation which might reflect the thoughts of survivors?
Well, leaving out a few colourful expressions, I had a gentleman on the phone who was in tears at the announcement of the Royal Commission, and he is someone who had the experience of reporting to the police, and the police took his complaint seriously, and there is actually a conviction against the Christian brother who assaulted him. So he said to me, "I can't believe it, I can't believe it, after all these years," he's now a man in his 50s, "I first told a copper who believed me, and now our Prime Minister believes me that we need to look at these issues." And he was just overcome with tears of relief and joy. He said, "I need to stop crying long enough to crack my first beer."
Dr. Vivian Waller from Waller Legal. Viv specialises in acting for survivors of sexual assault. You're listening to The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, on ABC Radio National, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. You can find today's story and more online at abc.net.au/radionational, and from there follow the links through to the Law Report page. And you can also continue the conversation on Twitter by tweeting at @LawReportRN. Now to the extraordinary case of a Perth couple known only as Mr. and Mrs. Stanford. Try and get your head around this. It was a long-running family law dispute that involved a happily married couple. Lawyer William Carr acted for Mr. Stanford in a prolonged legal battle with his stepdaughter. As he explains, the stepdaughter wanted the family court to step in and divide up Mr. and Mrs. Stanford's property after 37 years of happy marriage.
Well, Mr. and Mrs. Stanford were married in 1971. When they were married, they'd both been divorced and had settlements from their first marriage. Each of them had property, and the property was registered in their respective names. In 1995, Mr. Stanford made a will, and as the property in which he and Mrs. Stanford lived was registered in his name, he made a provision in that will that his property would be ultimately bequeathed to his children, subject to Mrs. Stanford having a life tenancy if she survived him. 10 years later, that's in 2005, Mrs. Stanford made a will in which she made provision for all of her property to be left to her children of the first marriage. So both parties had adult children by their first marriage. The interesting thing, which isn't apparent from the judgment, is that Mrs. Stanford's house, which she owned when the parties were married, was sold to her daughter early on in the marriage. So the adult daughter, who was ultimately involved in this case as her case guardian, had received that property. She and her husband had paid for it.
So the house owned by the mum is sold to her daughter at some at some point. Does she give full market consideration for that house?
I think there might have been a slight discount, but the property was ultimately sold, and the daughter made a substantial profit on the sale.
Now, this marriage is a long and happy one, but I think in about December 2008, Mrs. Stanford suffers a stroke. What happens at that point?
Well, Mrs. Stanford is then in residential care, and her daughters ultimately commence proceedings in the State Administrative Tribunal in Perth, and have one of them is appointed her guardian. In the middle of the following year, that's in August 2009, her daughter makes an application to the Family Court of WA for a property settlement on behalf of her mother as her case guardian, seeking a sale of Mr. Stanford's property and an equal division of the net sale proceeds.
Now, can I just go back a step? The couple haven't separated, have they? Okay, sure, Mrs. Stanford, I think, is now in care because of the stroke and I think also dementia that she's suffering, but there's no question that the couple have separated, have they?
No, they haven't separated in the legal sense that we know. The marriage hasn't broken down. They're separated physically by the fact that the wife has been admitted to hospital.
And Mr. Stanford is still supporting Mrs. Stanford, isn't he? It's not as though he's cut off.
He provides financial support for her. The care facility was provided for free, so there wasn't any major charges that were associated with her care. They were both Veterans Affairs and had the benefits that flow under that particular scheme. She was admitted to care, he visited her, and there was a sum of money available for extra expenses that she might have.
So the case guardian, the daughter of Mrs. Stanford, has gone to the family court. What has she actually sought from the family court?
Well, she sought a property settlement. She basically said that on account of the long marriage, 37 years of contributions, that her mother was entitled to an interest in that property, notwithstanding that the legal title to the property showed that it was owned by her stepfather.
What does the court decide? What does the court at first instance decide?
The court decided that she was entitled to 42.5% of the assets of the parties, which was a payment to her of about $613,000. And the magistrate said that he was to pay that within 60 days. Now, that was ordered at a time when clearly he was living in the home and didn't have any other accommodation.
So if that order had been proceeded with, your client would have had to have left the house, sold up, and handed that amount of cash over to the guardian of his wife.
Yes.
So this ruling of the court in Perth, the Family Court of Western Australia, is appealed by your client, Mr. Stanford. Yes. It goes all the way to the High Court. And last week, what does the High Court decide?
Well, the High Court decided that it wasn't appropriate for there to be a settlement in this case and dismissed the wife's application.
Was your essential argument that at the end of the day this wasn't a family law dispute? This was a dispute about wills and estates and how a couple had chosen to organise themselves financially and make provision for their respective children. Was that ultimately what you were arguing?
It wasn't so much an argument about wills and estates. It was an argument that because the marriage had not ended, it was described by us as an intact marriage, that the court ought not to exercise jurisdiction to determine the property interests of the parties when neither of them, in fact, asked for it. The wife wasn't asking for a property settlement other than through her case guardian. It was argued that both of them had made provision in their will consensually for their property to be left according to their own wishes, and that this was, in fact, an attempt by the daughters to secure an interest in property, and if they had secured that interest, then presumably they would have benefited under the terms of their mother's will.
So your argument was this was an attempt ultimately by the children of Mrs. Stanford to get an inheritance as opposed to thinking about the rights within a marriage of their mother.
Yes, yes. Obviously, their mother had no assets or not substantial assets under her own will. The mother, of course, died during the course of the proceedings, and that, of course, meant there was another legal argument that we had to deal with. But she died between the hearing of the appeal. There was two hearings on the appeal. She died after the first hearing.
What sorts of circumstances would it have been appropriate for the court to make a property settlement in favour of Mrs. Stanford or somebody like Mrs. Stanford?
Now, if it were the case that Mr. Stanford had made no provision at all for his aged and ill wife, there was certainly a remedy to seek the payment of a lump sum to do that. But in this case, clearly, her needs were being met in the particular aged care facility, and he had, as a dutiful and devoted husband, he had continued to provide for her financially.
So there was no question that the marriage, either one, the marriage was over, or two, that he had somehow abandoned her
Absolutely not,
her own devices. I guess flipping it around, if a spouse agrees to a settlement or to an arrangement that is less than that to which they are legally entitled, shouldn't it be open to those who are acting on their behalf to speak up or act for that spouse's best interests?
The spouses are entitled to make decisions among themselves during the pendency of their relationship as to the future destiny of their property. Now, if you are in a relationship with someone and you decide to buy property in a certain way, which often happens for a variety of reasons, it's not really up to third parties to decide whether or not that's an appropriate regime of property ownership.
William Carr, looking more broadly, as people live longer, presumably dementia and other forms of impairment that affect decision-making mean that there will be more and more guardians assuming responsibility for the property and the legal rights of their parents. Is this case an important one in working out how we address the issues raised by that ever-increasing reality?
Well, I think it is an important one. There is, of course, an ageing population in Australia, and there's a greater realisation now that dementia is a significant medical condition affecting people. This decision makes it clear that the family court has jurisdiction in these circumstances, but it is a jurisdiction that's got to be exercised with some considerable care. It doesn't provide carte blanche for somebody simply to go to the family court and seek a property division against the other party, requiring them to sell up their assets. One would have to look at all of the circumstances of the case, what provision's been made for the aged person who's ill, all those circumstances. It's not an opportunity for members of the extended family to secure their property rights in the future, which they would not otherwise have had.
William Carr, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report. What an interesting case.
A very interesting case. I'm glad it's over.
No doubt Mr. Stanford would agree with that. William Carr from Perth law firm Carr & Co. Now, from the High Court decision about whether there is or isn't a family law dispute to a High Court decision about whether there is or isn't insider trading. Last week's ruling in Mansfield and the Queen centres around the issue of whether you can be found guilty of insider trading if the information that you're relied upon is completely made up. Here's corporate law expert Michael Adams, Dean of Law at the University of Western Sydney, outlining the alleged facts in the case.
Well, a company called AdultShop.com, its managing director made some assertions, some promises to two people to say that, in fact, the company was rather making a $3 million profit, and this is in 2002, would make $11 million, and its turnover would go up from $50 million to $111 million. These two people then went and bought shares with that information, knowing that the share price would go up. In fact, of course, it came out that this was the managing director's imagination, and he also had added, by the way, that a packer was going to buy 4.9% of the company, which also had a dramatic impact on the share price. None of that information was in fact true.
And the managing director of AdultShop.com, a Mr. Malcolm Day, he allegedly told, I think it was Mr. Mansfield and Mr. Kizon, these porkies about where the company was heading. But in fact, there was no basis in reality to this information that was allegedly given to this pair.
That's right. My understanding is that they were completely false. It was an exaggeration by the managing director to have the influence of pushing up what's called pumping the share price.
And it is alleged that Mr. Kizon and Mr. Mansfield go on to buy shares on the basis of the information that they were allegedly told.
They would have known that Mr. Day was the managing director of the company, so would know this is reliable information, and as such decided to act upon it.
And the authorities get wind of these alleged events, and if this in fact occurred, it's insider trading. Now, for people who don't know what is insider trading and why is it illegal?
Insider trading is using confidential information that is price sensitive on the shares, going to have an impact before the market knows. and it can operate with good news and bad news. In this case, it would have been good news. And of course, once the market knows the greater profits, if that had been true, their share price would have gone up and they would have made a nice tidy profit. And that is fundamental against the market.
The rationale for insider trading being illegal is that we want to have a clear and transparent market where everybody can buy and sell on a level playing field.
That's right. The securities market relies on a theory called efficient market hypothesis, which simply means the share price reflects all available public information, so nobody should have an advantage over somebody else. The second part of insider trading is always that the people who are the insiders have a special relationship. So that is, the managing director here had inside information which nobody else has. By sharing with just a few people, it distorts the marketplace.
And gives them an advantage.
Yes, it gives them an advantage.
Okay, so Mr. Mansfield and Mr. Kizon, they're charged with breaches of the insider trading provisions of the Corporations Act.
Yes.
Which I think were, at that point, criminal charges.
That's right. This law was in place in January 2002. It was a criminal provision found in the Corporations Act.
Now, the defence is a wonderful defence. They say, oh no, this ain't information because it's not true.
That's right. Their first court in the Western Australian District Court, their defence was the information was false, which meant it wasn't real information, and as such, it could not be insider trading. And the judge accepted that argument.
And ASIC, the prosecutors, were pretty upset about this and they appealed it. And it's gone all the way to the High Court of Australia, who last week have given their wisdom on this point. What did they decide?
It's a unanimous judgment. And remember, this is 10 years after the fact, had determined that, first of all, information should be given its ordinary meaning. That is, if these assertions, these false allegations, were certainly information, and as such, these two gentlemen should be tried under a new trial for insider trading.
Justice Hayden had some really interesting things to say. He said, if the alleged facts were established and the decision had gone the other way, the result would have been irrational, because Mr. Kizon and Mr. Mansfield could have avoided facing charges, because even though they had exactly the same intention and potentially profited from the outcome of their actions, the authorities couldn't step in because the information was false.
It would have been a perverse outcome. That is, that these people who would have taken advantage of information from somebody they knew and themselves benefited from that lie, in that sense, even though they didn't know it was a lie, yes, would have been a distortion of the legislation.
The law as it stood back in 2002, these were criminal charges. I understand that the law around insider trading has changed. It's now more of a civil penalty. But nevertheless, despite the change in the law, this principle, which applied to 2002 insider trading, carries across to insider trading in 2012.
Yes, it's one of those interesting points where this transaction happened on the 4th of January 2002, and on the 11th of March 2002, the law was changed to take it from being just criminal to being a civil penalty. But in the area of information, and in fact the judges mentioned this particular fact, the outcome doesn't change. That is, information is normally the truth, but in this case, false information certainly attracts the possibility of insider trading. It is worth remembering, in this particular case, the judges have sent it back to the district court in Western Australia to her. So they are allegations of what they have done. So the High Court has not found them guilty, but sent it back to be decided upon.
Michael Adams, this case, it's almost funny. It's such a strange defence. Even if I did do this, the information upon which I acted was false, so there is no offence, and this can't go to trial. What does this case tell us more broadly about how the law looks at information?
I think it's a good example that the lawyers have thought carefully about the construction of insider trading, because it's a positive duty not to do something, and then they've turned it on the head. So it's a clever legal argument, but it does undermine the whole meaning of information. The concept of possession of information has been tested many times. And in fact, analogies are even drawn from the possession of drugs and other illegal substances, where you can say, you know, I didn't know they were in the car, but you actually were in possession and you should have known. So there are analogies, but with information, you know, it's a very fluid thing.
Professor Michael Adams, Dean of Law at the University of Western Sydney. That's the Law Report for this week.
Hello, Robbie Buck here from the Inside Sleeve. With a reminder that you can revisit some of the wonderful live performances and interviews that have been on the show as part of Australian Music Month. There's the a cappella of Aluka, the piano playing of Sophie Hutchings, and Archie Roach playing tracks from his recent album, Into the Bloodstream. To find them or any other Oz Music Month special, head to the Radio National website and look for Plan Your Listening. Or join me on the radio weekdays from 3 here on RN.